Hello and welcome to the Now Spinning Magazine podcast with me, Phil Aston. And on this episode, I'm absolutely delighted to have with me John Young from prog rock fantastic band Life Signs. John is a celebrated musician known for his incredible versatility and contributions to the progressive rock scene. You're a songwriter, keyboard player, composer, and you work with a diverse range of artists from Steel Eye Span to Bon Jovi, with a career that spans over four decades. Now, Life Signs is a band that I would describe as English pastoral progressive rock. That's my feeling when I listen to your music. And for those of you who aren't familiar with Life Signs, if you're looking for a reference point, now, this is what I personally feel. If you're a fan of early Genesis, Camel, Flying Colours, Transatlantic, Neil Morse, The Tangent, you'd be fairly close. But Life Signs is also a very much their own band. And you're about to... Welcome, John, first of all.
Thank you.
You're about to release a live album, I think, in July, and you're about to go on tour. So you're about to embark on quite a busy period for the band. So how are things going?
Well, it's interesting you put it like that, because with being busy, it's a great opportunity for the band. But also the fact is that we're all busy doing other things. This isn't what we do for a living, so to speak. So it's a question of, like, our drummer lives in Malmo in Sweden. Our guitarist lives in Baltimore in the States. Our bass player lives in Cardiff. So getting everybody back into the same room, our sound engineer or producer, Steve, has just come back from the Steve Hackett tour. I've been in Canada working with Rillian. And so... getting everybody in the same room is always—it's almost like a bit of a celebration in a way when we finally managed to get all the tickets to work to get everyone everywhere. But yeah, it's great. For most of this month, we're busy, and so we've got a UK tour to start with, just a short one, mainly up north, Manchester, Newcastle, Glasgow. There is one in Milton Keynes, and then we're off to Poland, Germany, and the Netherlands, which should be really good fun.
And you actually come back to my neck of the woods around September time, because I'm in Cornwall and you're playing Truro.
Yeah, we are. Yeah. Yes. It's quite funny, actually. I saw a mail from somebody that got in touch with me today who I've not spoken to in a long time. And I said in 2015, well, maybe one day we'll play Truro. And there we are. You know, it's happening. So we try, as a band, we try to get to as many places as we can. But obviously, it's very limited in terms of costs. One of the big bugbears for us is the States, because we have quite a good following in the USA. To get the band to actually physically play a note, it's $15,000 in visas first. And really, it's just crazy. I don't know how anyone can afford to do it at the moment, especially with newer bands, that's for sure.
Yeah, very true. I'm going to roll the clock back now to the beginning, because you're classically trained, aren't you? Was it Liverpool Metropolitan?
I was head chorister at the Metropolitan Cathedral, and that kind of went hand in hand. I was classically trained, and I didn't know anything about music in terms of popular music, and I was growing up in Liverpool. I mean, what kind of a situation is that? In Liverpool in the 60s, I knew nothing about it. But on one side of it, I used to sing, and for instance, Simon Rattle used to accompany me on the piano and stuff like that. From a classical point of view, it was great. And I really enjoyed the more obscure classical pieces. And I think when I was in sixth form at school, somebody introduced me to Led Zeppelin, and that was the end of it. You know, off I went.
God, that's really interesting, because my wife is a classically trained violinist, and she worked alongside Simon Rattle as well in Birmingham. So that's fantastic. Small world. Yeah. So you encountered Led Zeppelin, but obviously your leaning became more to do with the progressive rock. Who were your early influences in that field?
That's a very good question, because I only thought about it the other day, how bizarre it was, because initially I only had like one or two albums. I think we all probably started like that, and played them to death. And it was 10 years after and Led Zeppelin. And then a friend of mine said to me, who lived across the road, said, well, you like music. He said, you might like this band that's playing at the Liverpool Empire tonight called Genesis, and they're doing a thing called The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway. Well, that was it. That was the end of it for me. So I blame Peter Gabriel. I actually saw Peter Gabriel at Heathrow, not so long. I don't know him, but I saw him sort of from a distance, and I thought I should go over and blame him for everything, really, because that's where it all started. And I just thought it was amazing. And I went the first night knowing nothing. It was the only place they played three nights. And yeah. On the third night, I knew all the words.
Yeah, and it is a classic of that genre, isn't it?
Completely.
It really,
completely.
Really is.
Yeah.
Your first real break is with Uli John Roth's band in the mid-80s, which was, now that you've mentioned 10 years after in Led Zeppelin, I can see that that must have been a great step, you know, because, you know, guitar-centric music and a well-known name, you know, well, still is.
Yeah, to be honest, I didn't know who he was when I auditioned for the band.
Did that help, do you think? That you didn't?
Probably, in some ways. I mean, I turned up at this audition in London, it was a room full of Berkeley students, you know, and I just thought, okay, this is pretty serious. And then Uli asked me to do something ridiculous, which was he would keep changing key, and I had to use the correct cadences to follow him into the key, and then he would change key again. You'd have to go and find him again. And I did it for 5 minutes, and this is the story of the beginning of my life. And I put my hands up in the air. I said, I can't do this anymore. And he said, well, that's interesting. He said, you lasted longer than anyone else. And then I said, there was no I couldn't find the sustain pedal. And he said, you did it without the sustain pedal. I said, yes. He said, you've got a job. And that was how it worked. So,
oh, wow.
Quite bizarre, really. But one of the beauties of that time was that, because I used to go around – Uli was quite fastidious in those days. I don't think he is so much now, but he made me learn a lot of his guitar solos on keyboards. And so that gave me a guitar technique on keyboard, which has stood well through the test of time to an extent.
Yeah, because he used the tremolo arm a great deal. So so obviously you were able to, through the keyboards, I suppose, and synth sounds, you were able to almost follow that.
To an extent, yeah. Not so much from the tremolo point of view, but certainly from bending. You know, in terms of, I would say that. I mean, he was a master of all those things, and you know, the sky guitar that he has went, you know, an octave above where it was supposed to, or something. It was an incredible learning curve, and I really appreciate the mayhem that followed over the next year. You know, it was quite fun.
Because then quite quickly after that, you had Steely Span and Bon Jovi, Bonnie Tyler, who you were with her band for quite a while. So all of these different styles and things, did they sort of, you know, cement their way into your compositional approach to music?
I suppose I couldn't say no, Phil, but the thing I find interesting is that the gladiators of the 70s, so to speak, the people that we all look up to and we bought all their albums and everything else.
Yeah.
I was of a generation that came behind that. So, for instance, my next door neighbour until not so long ago was Dave Kilminster, who now plays for Roger Waters, you know. And we've all worked for the John Wettons of this world and together, and, you know, I was in Asia for a bit. And so you learn the techniques of the different bands. And, yes, you must add them to your vocabulary without question. But there are some things that I wasn't that keen on. For instance, I had to do the Emerson, Lake and Palmer stuff, but I was never really a big fan, but it was still a learning curve to an extent. So I think they all added to your repertoire. But looking back now, I was talking to Dave about this a while ago. Can you imagine going up to somebody from one of those bands and saying, can you do something outside of your comfort zone? You know, so if you went to a guitarist that you really liked and said, so why don't you play the blues, or why don't you play, you know, jazz fusion, or why don't... They'd probably find it quite difficult because they've only ever had to do that one thing. Whereas I think all the people that came along afterwards had to be masters of various different, or at least proficient in various different areas. You know, and there were various things I couldn't do at all, and I'd struggle with. But I think, you know, it's one of the things I find fascinating about today's musicians is who can and who can't. You know.
No, that's I've not thought of it that way before. That's a very good point that you, you say, they were the first bands through the gate playing that type of music, and they only really had their own kind of walls that they'd built to follow. But of the course. Musicians, like you say yourselves, that came up were obviously taking a bit of this, bit of that, learning that, and you say went to auditions, they had to learn huge repertoires that went across different bands, whereas they were in their own little world and just they didn't really come out of it.
Yeah,
so you're right. Obviously you were like a sponge, obviously soaking all this stuff. But equally, being able to play and interpret so many different things as well. You also you were co-writer on the Fish album, weren't you? Fellini Days.
Yeah.
I mean, what was that like?
Working with Fish was It was lots of fun, I have to say. I really like Fish as a guy, and I love the band. They were lovely people. But it was almost like being in, I don't know, some sort of soap opera from day to day, because there were always things happening. And it was never just simple and quiet. You know, there was always something going on, or some crisis or something happening.
Yeah.
And I loved all that. It was great. And, you know, you make some really good friends from it. The humor in the band was fabulous. And, you know, Fish is a much larger than life character. And I got to know him pretty well, I think, really, over those few years. And also, strangely enough, quite a few of the people involved with Fish over the years, like Dave Stewart, Robin Bolt, Steve Vances, they've all ended up working with me also in some guise or another. Robin's worked on the three Life Signs albums, and Steve and Dave were in the John Young band. So it's a very incestuous sort of scenario.
And, of course, Fish was part of Marillion during that part in the mid-80s, probably when the phrase or term progressive rock was at its lowest marketable element.
Completely. Yeah. I said to Lucy Jordash just recently, because the way that we work with Life Signs is we've kind of taken the Marillion mantle in terms of the model that they use. Wrong choice of words. The model that they use, and we've turned it into what we need for now. And I think that's, you know, what they did by, if you look at the way progressive rock worked through the 70s, it was very much, you know, the fans were very much alienated to an extent from knowing the bands. You know, you would go to a gig and you'd all stand outside the door, wait for somebody to sign it. They'd sign it, rush into the car, rush off, and that would be the end of it. Marillion were the first people to take the model of, actually, why don't we make friends with the crowd, make them part of what we do? And we sought to do the same thing. And I have actually had to point out to a number of major artists from the 70s, this is the way it works now. These people pay your wages. You know, they care about your music. You have to care about them. And I think probably back in the 70s, with, you know, obviously the amount of money there was and everything else, they were a bit more like football stars, you know, whereas I don't think that's the case now.
Yeah, I think bands back then were like mythical creatures that lived on the top of a mountain, hidden behind the mists. And to try and get to them, you had to write a letter using a pen and put it in the post, and it would go to a fan club and they'd reply saying, "We'll see if we can pass this on."
But yeah, they had to get past the keepers.
they were like untouchable. Whereas now, you can actually send a message directly to the person you've seen and say, "That was great, thank you."
Yeah.
I recently interviewed a band called When Rivers Meet, who are a blues rock band, and they're a young band, but they're also like you. They are dealing and building a relationship with their community of fans in real time. And that's why they're doing so well.
Well, it's a beautiful thing as well, because we found them then, you know, when we go and do a gig, it's like going to do a gig with your family, you know? And so everybody, like a lot of the fans, know each other. And if anybody's new, they get pulled in and everybody looks after them. And there's a wonderful community spirit. And we said the other day that, you know, doing a show is almost like leaving the planet for a couple of hours, because, you know, the planet is in such a terrible state, and you can fall back into music and music can take you somewhere else, you know. And it's such a gift to be given. And I really love it. It's fabulous.
And just before we come right properly onto Life Signs, you also played with the Straubs as well. You were a keyboard player about 2010 as well. And you've also done some instrumental albums after that. So this was just a few years prior to Life Signs. So when you were doing the instrumental albums, which I think were being used in advertising and stuff and TV productions, was that something you've carried on doing more of? And what was that like?
No, strangely enough, I've sort of sidled away from it over the years, because I've just got more involved with writing for Life Signs and making our kind of music. Yeah. But that said, it was a means to an end at the time. You know, I needed to create some income, and it helped. But it also showed you the darker sides of the music business. What's the Hunter S. Thompson phrase? You must know that the music business is shallow, trench full with vagabonds, thieves, and murderers, and it also has a bad side.
Yeah,
and so
I found
the bad side on several occasions. To give you an example, the war in Iraq, when that happened, CNN had this coverage which used all the newscasters, and the classical music underneath that was me. And I thought, oh, well, that's going to be good. I knew kind of what it should be worth. And they used it for 18 months nonstop through the, you know, all over the world. And I got £25.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And I got in touch with them and they said, yeah, that's fine. We know we're using your music. Sue us. Oh.
And that's not, they're not even like a small backyard.
Yeah.
Company, are they? A brand.
Bringers of truth and justice to the world. You know,
yeah.
Yeah, great, fine. That's how we work. You know.
So it just ends up something that's on your Wikipedia page or you're in your CV saying, I did this, by the way. But it, as you say, it's of no value to you as a working musician.
Yeah.
Well, Life Sign appears in 2013, and this is where I can join in myself because obviously I bought this album, and I said at the start, you know, Life Signs are like this pastoral English prog, and that cover, I mean, that image sums up that. I mean, were you, how did, was that, what's, is there a story behind that, the image?
Very much so. We were very much a family. I mean, there's only, basically we've got five in the band. If we use Steve, our sound engineer, is part of the band and has been since day one. And then we've got three people we work with on the road. And then we've got Brett, who does all our artwork. And that is a piece of Brett's artwork. Now, I'd commissioned something to be painted for the album, but unfortunately it just didn't really come together. And I'd seen this photo that Brett had done, and I said to him, I really like that photo. So he then enhanced it to be, you know, a Life Signs photo. And our artwork began from there, really. And when I said to him, so, you know, what beautiful scene is it? He said, I took that on the M6 going north. I said, what? And it's true. If as you go up the M6 going past Stafford, on the left-hand side, our album cover comes in 3D. You know, it's
Yeah.
So what, I hope we haven't been the cause of any accidents. Or
yeah, exactly, because it'll be one of those things, won't it? As the legend grows, people will be to try and be to see themselves waving from that location. I mean, it's also got some of your timeless classics, hasn't it? A Fridge Full of Stars. Not only is it a beautiful piece of music, it's one of the best song titles of all time.
Yeah, I can't really remember. I think Brett and I came up with that one. It's just, yeah, we do. And we've also got the happiest song about the end of the world on there as well.
Yeah, you have. At the end of the world, it's such a jolly tune.
Jolly tune, yeah, because I personally don't think it's such a bad thing at the moment. But it's... yeah, it's one of those things. I think what we try and do. Dave Bainbridge said to me on the way down the car just recently, we were going from gig to gig. He said, you know what we do? And I said, what's that? He said, we bring joy. And I thought, yeah, that's great. That's all, you know, what more could we try and do?
I think I totally agree with that you do. Right. I think your music is, I mean, one of the things I was going to mention, in, for instance, on Altitude, their most recent studio album, is that usually for a lot of people, when you listen to progressive rock music or some people that they think they know it or whatever, when you see, you know, you look at the song and it says, oh, it's 20 minutes long or 15 minutes long, you think, oh, right, this is going to be it's a long song and it's probably going to go off here. It's going to be a big seller. When you listen to Life Signs, I'm completely oblivious to how long the music is. I mean, for instance, that Altitude, the first track, which is 15 minutes, I was playing it to Sue in the car the other day, and there's that lovely violin playing, you know, which surfaces towards the end by Peter Knight. And as it was on, I looked at how long the track had been on, I hadn't noticed it. So the music is intricate, and obviously they are long songs, but they're songs. They're not workouts for the instrumentalist to, you know, flex their muscles. They're songs. I mean, how do they come together?
Absolutely like meant. Yeah. It's just, you know, I started, without being boring, I actually work by a process that's called channeling, which you can check up on TEDx. Yeah. I've been to all the lectures. So it just arrives, the music arrives. And I was writing this sort of pleasant song after the intro and thinking, oh, this is quite nice. And, you know, I love flying. I love anything to do with, you know, the sea or the air.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was thinking, this is great. And then I was just playing, and then the thing went target destroyed, and I was like, what, where did that come from, you know? And I suddenly realized that because generally the songs reveal themselves to me sometimes quite late after I've got involved in them, you know. And it was, I suddenly realized that in a drone, and the drone was looking at all the beautiful things, and then the drone killed something, you know. And what have we become, and why are we this? And then it went into the story of the person operating the drone, how would they feel, everything else. So it became a much longer piece than I initially imagined. But also, one of the things that we do from a musical perspective is that although we're quite progressive, and we're also, you know, a bit of pop, a bit of jazz fusion, all those kind of things, we tend to hide things. So a guy came up to me and said, oh, yeah, he said, altitude's all right. It's all in 4-4, isn't it? I said, not a chance. It's like, no way. And he said, well, what time signatures is it going to? I said, well, one of them's 57-64. And he went, you're joking. I said, no, it's got a 4 underneath it, but you wouldn't know because it's not in 4, you know. But so the thing you do is you disguise all these things and you just make it flow and blend, rather than going, oh, look, here's this bit that we're going into that's going to be, you know.
Yeah, yes.
You know, why bother? You know, just let it flow over you. It's a bit, in a way, life signs, I've always described, it's a bit like watching, you know, a swan or a duck or something serenely gliding along, and the feet are going like this, like crazy underneath. And so I do think that, you know, the players that we've involved in all through the three albums, you know, have all been magical. And we're so lucky to work with such great, great musicians.
I mean, talking about the musicians of being in the band or in the band, John Paul's bass playing is a key part of the sound, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I mean, when John came for the audition 10 years ago, he was recommended by Ed Paul, who I work with, his brother, who I work with the Bonnie Tyler band.
Yeah.
And said, oh, John could do this. And other bass players were coming in and going, oh, just give me a minute, I'll try and get this bit. Because Nick Beggs had done the original album.
Yeah, great player.
And then John came in and just played it and started dancing around the room, you know. And I thought, no question, you know, Zoltan was very similar when he auditioned in terms of just their ability to actually cope with the music was incredible. And John's been, you know, John's our musical director now. He runs everything in rehearsals, and, you know, he's just consummate musician. Can play anything.
It's brilliant. He's got that kind of like Marcus Miller kind of trebly, funky, slap, bassy thing but it just fits in with the soundscape that you're
completely playing. Completely. He has a thing on his bass guitar which says destroy all genres. I don't know whether you've seen that, but he can play any genre, you know. It doesn't matter if you ask him any questions about punk, new wave, psychedelia, you know, he'll know the answers to everything. It's incredible.
And you were mentioning that obviously what Altitude was about, and obviously it's a dark subject, but just like you said earlier, it's a very joyous song.
Yeah, because in the end it celebrates that we could be, you know, the whole thing, the clue through that is we could be so much better, you know, because if we put our minds to it, humanity could be so much better than it is. And it's only, I think, a number of idiots that are running everything. I mean, I'm not political, I'm not religious, but common sense dictates that we should just feed everybody rather than bomb them, you know? And
Totally.
I don't know. I mean, call me a hippie. I don't care.
No. I say a lot in my videos that music is the healer and the doctor, and it's music. It's the universal language, isn't it? It's an art form that connects us all.
Yeah. And also it heals. You know, I get messages from people saying that, you know, it's healed everything from personal problems through to physical problems. You know, we've had, our music has brought people together. I mean, you can't ask for more than that in life, really. You know, I mean, I'm not, somebody said, do you want to be famous one day? I said, no, I'd like to be heard. You know, that's the difference. You know, I don't really have any, I don't think the industry really has much to do with music these days, sadly.
No, because you can technically work outside of the industry. Like, you know, once you build up, you've got your community and people like you've done. I mean, one of your albums was, the target for your crowdfunding was met within 48 hours.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
I mean, that was without a record label, I guess. You know, that was people wanting you to bring out music and support you.
Well, there's a lot of hard work from the team itself. Yeah. I mean, obviously, aside from the musicians, myself, Steve, and Julie, and you know, we all tend to work you know, Julie sends everything out, makes sure everything runs. I sort of run the managerial side of it. So you work from dawn till dusk every day. But I remember a record company saying to us right at the beginning when we said, you know, I don't think we're going to sign. They said, well, you won't last a year. You know, well, we're 11 years on now, 10, 11 years on. So, you know, I think we've disproved that.
On your second album, well, the one after the Live in London one, which is fantastic, by the way, anyone watching this, you need to get, where is it? I've got it nearby.
Oh, you have everything, Phil.
I have everything, yeah. And the other one, Cardington, I really like because of, I like the last track, which is about the old airship hangars.
Yeah. Yeah, the R101 and the flight. I mean, it's an incredible story. And what led up to that was I was doing a solo gig in Norfolk. And I came back through to come to where I live. You have to come back past Cardington on the Bedfordshire roads.
Yeah.
And I just thought, you know what? I'm going to go and have a look at it in the moonlight. And this was, you know, all those years ago before they built the housing estates that are starting to go around it. And I went down there and I stood behind these huge monoliths and with the moon shining on them. I just thought, you could feel it. You know, you could feel that something terribly special had happened here. And it was indeed beautiful. And so then I researched more about the R101 and I saw these incredible pictures of this immense behemoth with, you know, somebody on a horse, pony and trap going past it or whatever. And you think, what was it like? You know, I mean, we marvel at the Concords and the Boeings and everything else that we see these days, Airbuses. But that must have been incredible, you know, in a tiny remote village in the middle of Bedfordshire, these two monstrosities, as far as the hangars were concerned, or the sheds, as they call them.
Yeah.
And then this these incredible machines that came out of them, you know. And, you know, within a little, if the song is about the circumstances that prevailed and the R101 crashed on its maiden flight. They've flown several flights before that. But the story of it and the history of it and the reason they shouldn't have done what they did, you know, if they hadn't have done that, would it have changed aviation? I don't know. Could have done.
Yeah, that's very true. You just don't know. The band Life Signs has had, they've had quite a few lineup changes, but I think the other thing that I really like about your ethos and who you are, it's almost like a family, is on your website, you also list ex-members and they're still, in a way, part of it. You talk about their influence and what they did and what they're doing and where, you know, and what they did up to that point. Is that important to you?
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, we couldn't have done it without the input of everybody through the years. You know, Nick Beggs was on the first album. We didn't have a guitarist for the first album, so we used different guitarists to play on it. So Jacko Jackson came on to play one song and, you know, well, there was just a number of people. Robin Bolt was the main guy that came in and did most of it. Second album was pretty similar because we were changing at the time because Nico decided to go. Nico had worked for Stephen Wilson, Nico Sonov. Amazing guitarist. And then, you know, so we had him. We had Menno Hutches from Focus came in. Obviously, Tyche had been on the first album. Nobody ever said no. This was a very interesting point. And I loved the contributions everybody gave. And then Dave Bainbridge came in and managed to let Frosty was amazing on drums, you know, for those.
Brilliant player. Yeah.
And then Zoltan just came in again. Great stories with Zoltan. You know, he just came in and everybody was saying it would take them 2 weeks to learn N, you know, the song N. And Zoltan sent it back to us in 3 hours and then apologized for it taking so long, but he had to take his son to school, you know. So we knew then that this was going to be, you know, a wonderful thing. And when we first started rehearsing with Zoltan, John realized what an amazing drummer. Ron Stolt got in touch with me and said, you just got one of the best drums. And Zoltan left at 3 o'clock in the morning to come to us and then rehearsed through till lunchtime and was probably quite tired. And John was just laying into him with all these things they could do. And at one point, John went, oh, I'm really sorry, really sorry. He said, I didn't realise you've been up since three. You must be knackered, you know. And Zoltan just looked across the drum kit at John and went, I love you. I knew a rhythm section had been born at that point, you know, and it was just fabulous. It's been an incredible ride, some wonderful humor, some amazing things spiritually that have happened with everybody, things that we feed off, you know, and you can see that from what goes on, you're doing the right thing. I think with that, I mean, I'm going off subject here, but the epiphany for us was doing Cruise to the Edge last year, where you know, we had a standing ovation after every number. The theatre was packed out right to the back. A lot of the other bands came to see us. A lot of people from major bands that we've all got records of went, we want to be in your band, you know. And I thought, okay, box ticked. You know, that's what we came here to do. That's what we're doing. And anything else is a bonus, to be honest. So,
and Dave Bainbridge, as obviously is with you now, he's an amazing player and his background covers so many different, well, a bit like you're saying about, you know, the bass player saying, you know, death to all genres. I mean, Dave comes from such a varied background, doesn't he?
Yeah, it's wonderful. I mean, obviously he has strong Celtic roots in terms of Iona and everything else. And Dave works, he's very industrious, you know. I love his ethos as far as, you know, getting to grips with everything. There's nothing he'll turn down, nothing he can't do. We had a funny situation with Prog Magazine a couple of years ago where I won best keyboard player. And I'm not even the best keyboard player in our band. It's a bit like Ringo not being the best drummer in the Beatles, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
John plays great keyboards as well. And now Zoltan's told me he plays keyboards. I feel quite threatened, actually. But it's true, you know. I mean, I look at Dave's playing. Dave's a magical jazz player as well. Incredible, absolutely incredible. So talent on the stage is, you know, I just sometimes stand there and watch it and just think, how did you end up here? You know, I mean, Pete Travis said to me on the plane out to Montreal recently, he said, you've got an incredible band, you know. And I said, yeah. I said, you know, I don't know how that happened, really.
I think because that what comes across is that you're all equals on stage. Yes. I mean, I know that the, you know, that you've got a new live album coming out soon, but on the one that's been out for a while, it's obvious from the musicians that, as they were in that band and from what you've said, it's always continued. You're all just, well, there's not one musician, you know, like you could see some bands where a musician is completely in their own little world. They're doing their thing, but they're not necessarily connected to the others. There's a bigger light on this person. There's a smaller light on that person over there. Mm. But with Life Signs, all the lights are the same, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree. You beautifully put, actually, Phil. I have to say, I've had this conversation with a number of people. But one of my problems is when I go and see, especially sort of major acts of the past, then it will be about a person or it will be about four people all trying to be the person that catches your attention.
Yes.
You know, and I want to see a band. You know, it's like if you go and see Uriah Heep, you go and see a band, you know, and that's what they do. And I think it's really important that this is what happens with us, you know. And I think everyone has respect for each other's abilities and we're all good friends. You can't ask for more than that. John said to me, you know, we've really hit a sweet spot. And I said, yeah, and you can't always guarantee that's going to stay. But as it stands at the moment, you know, I mean, I did an interview for a guy on BBC local radio a while ago. We haven't actually managed to get to the Halcyon's, you know, end of the BBC market. But he said, so how would you describe your music? And I said, deeply unpopular, you know. And he said, why is that? I said, well, you know, we're not played on anything mainstream. I said, you know, nobody will pick that up, no mainstream press. And he said, why would that be? And I said, well, part of the problem could be the BBC. And he stopped the recording and he said to me, absolutely agree with you, you know. So I don't know how you feel about these things, but it's great chatting with someone like yourself who understands music and everything else. But you listen to the BBC radio going, oh, and here's another one from so-and-so, and this is really good, I like this. You know, it's like, you know, what happened to the Bob Harris's and the Alan Freeman's and the people that gave you the information you needed to actually make some decisions about proper music, you know? And I'm not saying there aren't good musicians around, but I do feel sorry for, you know, a lot of the younger bands coming through at the moment. And we try and support them wherever we can because there's some brilliant bands coming through that should be, you know, being played on radio too. Ebony Buckle, who's supporting us at this next gig, you know, she's amazing. Absolutely amazing. Her and her husband make beautiful music, but who's gonna be brave enough to go in there and make it happen?
Yeah. I think the media is broken. The traditional routes to being found, you know, going on, finding your way through to a radio play and then waiting for the weekly music newspaper Sounds of a Melody Maker Enemy to come out on a Wednesday and then to see it and say, look, we've arrived. That can be completely circumnavigated now by YouTube and social media and all sorts of things, and also you're kind of like Uber fans, because you don't need loads of them. You just need a few people who just almost broadcast out to their people saying, I found this band, I love them, you know, give them a listen. And it just amplifies in an organic and natural way. So as you said earlier, you've got fans who start to meet up, and meeting each other becomes part of the experience of going to see you live. So when they go to the bar, they go hi and they talk to each other. So they're building relationships with each other, which builds a stronger bond with you, the band.
Completely.
So they're saying on the way out, you know, are you going to go to the gig at whatever?
Yeah.
And then they say, well, let's meet up, which is, you can't get that from the radio.
No.
So in a way, I agree, the BBC are making themselves, or any radio station that follows the old route, they're making themselves less relevant to the music fans who are looking for something, you know, something new. And again, going back to what you said, your music being deeply unpopular, whatever, progressive rock, the word progressive means that you don't really know what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
Because if you want your band to just keep replicating the previous album, it's no longer progressive technically, is it? It's
No. Well, to me, I mean, a lot of people, the problem is I think there are two kinds of fans. There are ones that want to feel safe.
Yeah.
And there are ones that are more experimental. Now, I was always one of the ones that was a bit more experimental. So, you know, I'd go and see Genesis one day and then it would be Weather Report the next day or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. And try and take in all these different facets and see. So I noticed that, for instance, on the cruise, when we had a funny moment because we did our gig on the deck and I wasn't too happy with it, but I think the sound was okay. It was just purely because it was so windy. And then I had a tap on my shoulder and it was Simon Phillips. And he said to me, John, could we borrow Steve? And because they obviously liked the sound.
Yeah.
So Simon borrowed Steve for the gig the next day. And we became quite good friends on the cruise, which is one of those things that's wonderful. But I noticed when I was watching Protocol, which is his band, you know, there were a number of proggers walking around looking a little bit like, this isn't prog, you know. And to me, I thought it was exceptional, you know, absolutely exceptional. I used to go on these cruises. I've always been to go and see Brand X or whatever, because I just love the music. But it is an acquired taste, you know. So sometimes it doesn't quite get past that.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to get past the comfort zone, and I think we push a few boundaries, but we try and do it delicately so that people can discover it as it goes. Because there's at the end of when we get to the end of Fortitude, there's a big sort of Genesis type element, but then at the end of Shoreline, there's kind of a jazz rock, jazz fusion element, you know, and it introduces people to that and those abilities. You know.
It's also incredibly accessible, which a lot of progressive rock isn't. It can sometimes be very targeted towards blokes of a certain age. In some ways, it becomes like a special club. But I think but what you do, going back to what you're saying about when people on stage, each member of the band is sharing the light, but all the members of the band are also serving the song.
Yes. So
the song is the song sits above everything.
Gosh, you've got it in one there, Phil. I mean, the song is the most important thing. So basically we realize that we all, you know, we're all owned by the song. And I think it's important also from the point of view, as you said, if it's progressive but it still feels like a song, then there are two elements to it. So you can look for the depth and the structure, or you can just sing along the melody, you know.
Yeah.
And so if you do that, we've been amazed recently. Well, we were amazed originally, but now it's pretty much become the norm, where a guy would come in and go, well, he said, I like it. He said, but my wife likes it as well, and the children like it, you know. That's because we're doing something a little different, I think, you know. So as long as we can keep going like that, I'm happy. I think it's a good thing.
Well, as you said earlier, it's joyous, and there's a lot of melody. There's a lot of melody in the music, and it's incredibly accessible. So it's just about it's about being heard.
I think going back to what you were just saying, the songwriting aspect also probably comes from, I spent a lot of time working with John Wetton. I think he was a genius. He had his good days and bad days, as we know, but it was, you know, the things that he taught me through that time about the way you structure something, the way you make something work, the way you can put something, you can still keep something as, you know, would be regarded as progressive, but turn it into something that you might hum, you know, That I always thought was the within progressive rock, that's probably the most important thing. You know, not get lost in your own self-indulgence. It's not worth it.
I mean, because John Wetton was brilliant at that, wasn't he, with Asia?
Completely,
and,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Some of those hit singles. And, of course, even, I think, you know, that Yes during that period also had big hits as
Very
well.
Much so. Yeah, yeah. I loved all of that. And I loved what he did with UK. I always thought that was, you know, for me, my favourite period was probably UK, Brand X, Bruford, all that kind of stuff, because I really just, I enjoyed that. But then again, you could turn around and say, well, there probably wasn't enough melody, you know. And so if you can incorporate the two things and, you know, put some really devious chords in underneath something that sings beautifully, then you're halfway there, I think.
Well, I've mentioned the previous live album, but you have a new one due, don't you? Yes. Literally next month. Can you?
Yeah. Yeah, it was recorded in Holland. And yeah. We just, you know, we decided that with the altitude thing being accepted so well, but it would be a shame, especially with the band being as good as it is at the moment, it'd be a shame not to capture that. And yeah. So that's kind of what we hope we've done. And I think it's, we were surprised actually, because we turned up in Holland not knowing. Somebody, was it one of the guys from Focus said to me a couple of weeks ago, he said, it was amazing what you did in Holland. And I said, well, I said, it's not out yet. You know, he said, no, he says, it's just the fact that people were standing, singing and clapping.
Yeah.
He said they were singing along, they were clapping. They, you know, he said, that doesn't really happen in Holland. And I said, I was oblivious to that, you know. So
well, yeah.
I think that's the thing, is you can get that atmosphere. We found recently with some of the more sort of catchier songs like Impossible and Last One Home, that people will sing them back to us when we've finished the song, you know. So we're seeing all these new things happening, and it's beautiful, because it really brings tears to your eyes when you're on stage. You know, it's quite
well.
Incredible.
You know you've connected on so many different levels, don't you? And in a way, I know I introduced the band as being a progressive rock band at the very start, but and that can have some people who don't know a band, they make some assumptions on that. But you don't normally think of a prog rock band where people are singing along with and they know the words.
That says
a lot. Actually, on the album Altitude, this was recorded all in your home studios. And obviously on the album, it actually says in accordance with 2020 lockdown. I mean, that's going to be like a point in time, isn't it? And then years to come, people will see that and think, what does that mean? I mean,
yeah.
I mean, you also recording like that, when you realize that's how recorded and then you listen to the album, it shows you how recording techniques have changed, because there's no way I would think that you weren't together when that was done.
No, we weren't. Yeah.
You wouldn't pick up on that at all. It sounds, especially as I mentioned, you know, where Peter's playing the violin and all that, it just sounds like you're all in the same room.
Yeah, in fact, strangely enough, the only point where we were in a room with somebody was when we recorded the cello with Juliet Wolfe.
Oh, yeah.
Because we recorded that down at her dad's studio in London. And she's a wonderful classical cellist. And that was the only point where Steve and I were in the room with another musician. So everybody did their own thing. And I was really pleased with the way that it worked, in terms of, because we've always got suggestions, you know, what about this? What about trying that? And I do sometimes have to hold them back a little, you know, because they are very, very good. And so there comes a point where you just want it to sing and you point out what you'd like to do. And like any, you know, like any band, there's an element of, you know, dysfunctional family. And we all, you know, somebody might get annoyed about something, or somebody might want to do something a different way. But in the end, we come to a community decision. As Steve says, we do everything by community, and he's not always sure that's the easiest way of doing it, but it gets us to the point where we can release the album as it stands, you know. And I think that's shows you how strong the band is, that we can go through these things, and then we'll all go for a pint together when we can, you know. So
yeah,
it's very much, I mean, you know, I'm busy organizing rehearsals at the moment, but I'm also organizing the curry night and other bits and pieces, you know.
Essential, yeah.
Vital, absolutely vital, yeah.
So how did it feel when you first were able to play live together in front of a real audience? I mean, after all the lockdown.
After COVID.
Yeah.
Well, I think the thing was, we were quite nervous. In fact, that happened here at Milton Keynes. We were quite nervous because obviously it's the first time that we were doing Altitude live.
And yes.
it's a big, you know, it's a big ask. It really is. You know, it's not simple. But I think, you know, again, because it was such a community before COVID and that built through COVID as well. And then when the album happened, it was so widely accepted by the people we knew. And it's quite funny when we do a show, you know, we'll say at the beginning of the show, any virgins in tonight, you know, so it's always good to see who are the people that have not heard it before. But we've noticed that with that now, there's definitely more women coming, more younger people coming. There's more people being turned onto it. So I think really to an extent for all of us, we've all really thrived off, you know, these last few years and what it's brought to us. And anything else is a bonus. You know, absolutely anything else is a bonus. So, yeah.
With the new live album coming out, are there any thoughts about putting out a vinyl version with the way that vinyl has made a resurgence?
I've been asked that three times already today.
Oh, sorry.
You know, just today, people get in touch saying, can we have, because our vinyl is a thing of beauty, obviously, with Brett's artwork, you know. So yeah. We're going to have a discussion about it, I think. It is coming out as a Blu-ray at the end of the year. So initially there's the audio, which is a double CD. And that's going quite well. I have to say it was just on pre-release at the weekend. So, it's great. You know, we're a kind of small community, but growing, shall we say.
Fantastic. And where's the best place for people to direct them to go to buy your material?
Yeah, thanks for that, Phil. It's just us. Just come to the website, www.lifescience.co.uk. Now, the thing that we've been doing recently was initially when we went to, again, it's the same thing. You're trying to change the way the engine works, you know.
Yeah.
So we initially went to distributors and they were like, no, we can't do this. So, well, you know, we put our prices up. They go, you can't do that. Why? You know, it's just a CD now with inflation should be over £50, you know. Now, a CD, they still regard as being £12, £14, whatever. So we decided last year, it goes up with inflation now every year. All our prices go up with inflation. Our CDs were £20 when they started with the Altitude. And we found other bands starting to adopt this because we think it's really important. If music is going to survive, you have to pay the going rate. We're not on Spotify. We don't put anything on there in terms of, we've got a couple of, you know, you can listen to us here and don't forget to go to the website. But we won't fall into that trap, or we refuse to fall into that trap of being bound by everything then going down in price. So when we speak to people that we supply, we say, well, you know what? This price doesn't change. You know, in fact, the only thing it will do is go up. Now, if you take that to the vinyl level, we were at a gig the other night, and we're still selling the second album and the third album on vinyl. The first album is sold out. There isn't a repress at this moment in time. So this guy said, I'll have the second and third albums on vinyl. So he bought them. And he said, I wish I could get the first one. And the guy next to him said, oh, I've got the first one. He said, I've got it from Germany. It was £160.
Wow. Yeah.
Now, that's the way that music with value is seen. So why can't it apply from day one with the bands, and the bands can just afford to make a living? I think it's really, really important. And I've noticed, I've had this chat with Arena and with Pendragon, and I've noticed they're moving up as well now. And I think it's really important. If you want music to survive, you have to put value back into it. That's the only way.
I totally agree with you because, you know, the days of when a CD was £10 or the vinyl album, whatever, was £20 have gone, and you're trying to support the band. And if you're going to spend £25 on a T-shirt, then it, you know, £20, £25 on a, you know, the two CD set or whatever seems absolutely fine. And also, I think what I am seeing as well from a lot of people within the Nice Spinning Magazine Facebook group and the community on other platforms is that people now are going more and more directly to the artist, you know, rather than Amazon. In fact, Amazon usually don't have it now, you know, for a lot of, especially new bands or new releases, they seem to be last in line, you know, to get this. And I feel if you're going directly to the artist and maybe it's going to get signed, or you have a signed note that comes with it, it goes back to what you said earlier about those days when musicians were out there on the misty mountain top and you couldn't get hold of them. Now you can talk directly, but you feel as if all of my hard-earned money is going to support the artist in the best way that I possibly can.
No, indeed it is. You know, I mean, we're fortunate. We can pay the band some money every month, that kind of thing. We can, you know, we're not self-sufficient, and we realize that, but we're going to try and work towards that, obviously. Yeah. But I do feel that it is up to, in terms of the industry and the people buying the music, it's about a game change in your head as to, do you give it value or do you regard it as free? You know, if you regard it as free, then it will just die. Everything will just die. So what you need to do is put the money back in so that people can invest. The thing is that you might say, well, CDs should still be at 1980s prices. Mixing desks aren't, you know, cabling isn't, you know, everything else that we have to use, the iPads, all the bits and pieces on stage, and everything goes up accordingly. So, you know, fine. If you want to pay 1980s prices, put the gear back down to 1980s, it's not going to happen. So we need to come into the current age. And I think it's good that people are starting to adopt this. We've actually got a policy on the website where you can pay the going rate for our albums or give us a tip, you know, on top of what we're asking. 1 in 3 give us a tip, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, because if you go eating out in a restaurant, they'll add a discretionary service charge. So, I mean, and that always feels a bit, you know, you haven't really got the same relationship as you have with a band and some musicians. But with streaming taking up 85% of the market and 15% being about physical releases, those people who support physical music are very, very passionate about making sure that the artists can continue to create music.
And so it's a thing of, I mean, just looking behind you now, yeah, it's a thing of beauty, isn't it?
It is. It is. And it goes beyond just listening to it. So it's actually having the copy, sometimes just sitting down, even if it's not actually playing, but you can relive those memories of seeing the band just by having it near you. You know, it's not just in your grey matter. So I do think that's very important, and I think your approach is very healthy, you know.
Good. I'm pleased to hear that.
I really do. Well, thank you very much, John, for all of your time. I'm going to put a link to the website, which is lifesciencemusic.co.uk. I'll put that on the website and on the YouTube channel, and all the tour dates are on there, aren't they, as well? You kick off the end of this week, the time of recording this. And you're going right to, well, the short tour of UK, and then you're off, where is it? It looks like Germany and Poland, is it?
It's Poland, Germany, and the Netherlands, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And are you hoping to go into the US?
We'd love to. I mean, also because, you know, we do have a fairly good fan base there now. But as I say, it really is a question of costs. I think what might happen first is, because it costs you to get into the USA. It doesn't cost you to get into Canada. So we may go to Canada first and do some shows there and see how that works.
Cool. The question I should have asked as well before we go is, you've got the live album coming out, but are there plans to do a new studio album?
Yeah, started working on that, started working on some ideas, throwing a few things around between us in the same way that we did with Altitude, and we'll see what comes of it, yeah.
Fantastic. Sure. Well, thanks again, John. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you with me. So thanks, everyone, for watching and listening. And check out Life Science website, buy their CDs, support the band, go and see them live. And also check out Now Spinning magazine as well at nowspinning.co.uk. So thanks, John, and take care. And hopefully I'll talk to you again soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. Much appreciated.
So a big thank you to my guest, John Young from Life Science. And I just have to say, any of their albums, and this one from 2013, Altitude, this is the latest one, and this one, Cardigan, and the live album as well. And of course, there's a new live album out very, very soon, Live in Holland, are all worth getting. And this band isn't on the streaming services, so go to lifesciencemusic.co.uk, where you can buy signed copies of the album and support the band directly. Absolutely fantastic band, and a great guy as well. And we found that whole band are just superb. So thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being here. Please support Now Spinning Magazine by becoming a patron or a subscriber. Check out the YouTube channel, Facebook group, and all of our platforms. And of course, nowspinning.co.uk. See you on the next one. Thank you.